Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Tana French is the author of four highly acclaimed novels of suspense. She grew up in Ireland, the U.S., and Malawi, and trained as an actress at Trinity College in Dublin. She's worked in theater, film, and voiceover. And then came fiction. Her books include In the Woods, The Likeness, and Faithful Place. They have won Edgar, Anthony, McCavity, and Barry Awards. Her latest is Broken Harbor, and it takes its name from the former seaside resort where Mick Scorcher Kennedy from Faithful Place vacationed as a teen with his family. It's where he remembers being happiest. It's also the point in time and space where he now believes things went south for everyone. It is a great pleasure to welcome Tana French to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
At what point did you know that you wanted to have a series? Just because the way this series is laid out, that there is no one narrator, it gives me the idea that perhaps this all caught you a bit off guard.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I had no clue what I was doing. Still don't. I was finishing up In the Woods, and I started to think, my God, if this sells someday, if somebody actually buys it, they might want another one. And I started thinking about the series idea. The standard thing is to stick with the same narrator, right, from book to book. But I like writing about the points where the narrator, the huge turning points in the narrator's life, the moments where he knows or she knows that whatever decision he makes, this is going to define the rest of his life either way. And the thing about real life is that you don't have that many of these moments in a lifetime, like, what, two or three? So either I could keep dumping this poor guy into huge life-changing situations every year or two, or else I could do the more standard series thing, which is to follow him kind of through the smaller ups and downs of life, which I love reading those series, but which I wasn't interested in writing. Or the only alternative was to switch narrator. And I also liked the idea of being able to show a character from a different perspective. What I do is I take a supporting character from one book and turn him or her into the narrator of the next one. And I like the idea that what you see of someone from outside isn't necessarily the whole truth, that everyone looks completely different from inside their head. That idea of people being quite a subjective experience and knowing anyone being subjective. And I liked bringing the audience into that.
I want to talk about that in just a moment, but before we do, the idea of having multiple narrators, now that you are four books in, is it a lot to juggle in the sense of knowing what this character is and being careful to set up perhaps this character for their own entry later on in the series?
Well, I don't. I just kind of hope that there will be a character who'll turn into a logical next starting point. You know, I don't set it up deliberately. The juggling thing is actually really enjoyable because I'm coming from an acting background. Like you said, I worked in theater for a long time. And in a lot of ways, writing is first person, which is what I do, is the same thing. You're playing a character. You're creating the whole fictional world through this character's fears and needs and preconceptions and drawing the audience into that world, hopefully to the point where they feel like they know this character intimately. And I would say it would get a little bit tedious playing the same character forever. It would be like being in a run of, you know, Cats or The Mousetrap or something that goes on forever where you're glad to be doing it, but sometimes you kind of would like a change. And I like the fact that I have to start over with a new character every couple of years and get to know this person. I like that opportunity.
But through it all, there is this umbrella of the Dublin Murder Squad. And that allows you some continuity.
Yes, it does. The Dublin Murder Squad doesn't actually exist. I invented it. I kind of there's what there is a national overall bureau that handles all different kinds of crime. But I like the idea of this very tight-knit, elite, high-pressure squad where you know you're the best of the best and you have to live up to it all the time. I thought that was more interesting to read about, and so I just kind of, you know, invented the murder squad. And it means that whatever dynamics I've set up in one book can be picked up later on if they happen to come in useful. Like, there's a character who's kind of shown up a couple of times, Quigley, who showed up as this annoyance in the first book, just this guy who is always around at your most vulnerable, when you're feeling down. He's always around to make things worse. And he actually plays a fairly crucial role in this book, Broken Harbor. Years later, I went, oh, that he would actually gel into this plot really well. So I get the chance to pick up threads that I've started years ago.
So give us a sense in this case where Mick Scorcher Kennedy comes in. This is the detective. He's very much by the book. He played a large role in Faithful Place. He was antagonizing Frank Mackey. So at what point does your imagination take over and say, okay, this is what this guy should be doing at this point?
Oh, he was totally not meant to be the narrator of this book, I have to say. Again, like you said, in Faithful Place, he's this rule-bound, uptight pain in the neck, basically. But that's what I was saying before. He's kind of being seen through the narrator Frank Mackey's perspective. And Frank has just found out that his first love died. It was murdered. He is looking for something to fight. He's looking for an enemy. And until he finds the killer, Scorcher will do just grand to be somebody he hates. And so he's not seeing him in the most flattering light. But when I started writing Broken Harbor, it became obvious that this was a book about people who somehow had wound up living on these ghost estates that litter Ireland nowadays. These estates that should never have been built to begin with, but that my generation, the 30-somethings, were really pushed to buy on. We were told this is the right thing to do. This is the only way you'll ever get onto the property ladder. You have to do this. Now, we were lucky and we didn't, but the people who did were the people who stuck to the rules. They were the people who believed in a right way of living life and who really tried their best to live life the right way, to do things the way they were supposed to do them. The original narrator I'd planned for this book was another character from Faithful Place, was Stephen, kind of this young, eager, up-and-coming detective. But the more I thought about it, the more it became obvious that this was not his book. This kind of desperation to live by the rules and to do things the right way gelled with Scorcher Kennedy. And I wasn't particularly pleased because, again, he's kind of a pain. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to write him for 2 years. And I wasn't sure that I could really ask you guys to read him for a few hundred pages and expect you to like it. But I thought about it more and more. And I went, from their own perspective, no one's a boring git. Nobody is annoying or wrong or evil. Everybody's got a reason. And a perfectly good reason for acting the way they do. So my job here was to get my preconceptions about Scorcher Kennedy out of the way and to let him have the space to tell his story. And he started to be more complicated and more passionate and much more damaged than I had seen him as in Faithful Place. And as I realized that, and as I realized that he had very good reasons for going by the rules, he believes that your mind is not a reliable thing. You can't rely on your own gut instincts. They will lead you wrong and terrible things will happen. And he's got reasons for believing that. So you have to stick to the rules. And as I realized that he had reasons for thinking that way, he became easier and easier to write.
And I assume that at the point that you are won over, in the sense of that we are going to care about this character once that passion and once we see a glimpse of someone that we like.
Yeah, I think so. Or of someone that we can empathize with.
Right.
I think that's why my narrators tend to be pretty badly damaged in one way or another. Like, I mean, Cassie in the likeness, it's temporary damage. It's not a lifelong thing. But the others have been damaged in some lifelong way. And I think that's always more interesting to read about because most people have been damaged in one way or another. Like, you're a very lucky person if you make it over, what, 25 without something really bad happening to you that shapes you forever. And so most people are, in one way or another, trying to work with damage. They're trying to assimilate it, trying to suppress it so they can function, trying to work with it or against it or in some way cope with whatever damage life has thrown at them. I mean, it's not the exception. It's the basic rule. It's how life works. And we like to read about people who, in the same way, are trying to find ways to cope with damage. There's nothing interesting about reading about a character who's just perfectly happy and contented in his life. I mean, it's like watching some guy sit on his couch playing PlayStation and eating Doritos for a few hours. He's having a great time, but there's nothing interesting there. You need the character who you can empathize with and who is doing the same thing that we're all doing, which is trying to work with damage.
You mentioned that video game playing moment, which from my understanding, it was your husband playing Xbox that ultimately led you to writing in some way.
Well, no, it didn't lead me to writing, but it's very much been a part of my writing life for a long time. We were sharing a little tiny flat, and he was killing zombies on the Xbox about 6 feet away. So he kept the world safe for me, because you cannot write with a zombie eating your brain, and I wrote.
At what point did you say, okay, I'm going to take a break from acting and I'm going to work on this? Because as you say, you were very successful in acting. And
well, no. Well, I did. I was doing okay.
You saw success.
I got work, which is, for a lot of actors, that's the definition of success.
Sure.
It's just being able to work. I mean, it was always theater, so it wasn't film. It wasn't the big stuff. But the writing was completely, this was not the plan. Yeah, the plan was to keep working. I was in a theater company. We were doing good stuff. That was the plan. But the thing is, if you're not like tremendously successful, and I totally wasn't, the gigs don't line up neatly. Like, you don't go straight from one to the other. And you've got to pay the rent in between anyway. And so in between two gigs, I got myself, instead of, you know, the waitressing or whatever, I got myself a few weeks work on an archaeological dig. I've always been fascinated by archaeology. I'd done one before. I knew I could do it. And while I was on this dig, there was a wood not far away. And I thought, whoa, that would be a great place for kids to play. And instead of stopping there, like a normal human being would, I like mysteries. I'm always looking for the potential mystery in everything. And I went looking for the potential mystery in this wood. I thought, so what if three kids ran in there to play and only one came out and he had no memory of what had happened to the other two? And I kind of scribbled down the idea on a piece of paper. I went off to do the next show and I forgot the whole thing. But a year later, I stumbled on that piece of paper, like under phone bills. It had coffee on it. And I thought, that, I really want to know what happens with that. And I knew the only way to find out what would happen was to write the book. Nobody was going to do it for me. I was pretty sure I couldn't write an entire book because I had never even tried before. But I thought I could probably write one little bit and then maybe another little bit. And then, whoa, I've got a chapter. And the big moment that you talked about when I realized that I'm serious about this was when I turned down acting work. If you know any actors, they always want more work. They will take all the work they can eat.
Right.
And so when I heard myself saying, thanks for the offer, I'd love to do the show, but I can't, I'm working on something else, I was like, what are you saying? What are you doing? But that was when I knew that I was really serious about finishing this book. It was a very strange feeling.
Tata French is the author of Broken Harbor. It is the new novel from Viking. When you made that leap and said, okay, this is what I want to do, and you joked at the beginning of our conversation of, you know, this is what you wanted to accomplish, and in some ways you're still trying to figure it out, did the success just blow you away? Because along this, I mean, over the last 5 years, you look at what you have put out, and the readership and the following that you have is really quite extraordinary.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I would like to shake hands and say thank you to every single person who's bought this book. It did completely take me by surprise, but I think coming from acting kind of made it make more sense in a way, because acting is another job where you're constantly rolling the dice, and you know that whether it's success or failure that comes your way, you can't take it personally. You can't think either that it's because you're terrible or because you're just wonderful, because a certain percentage of it is talent, a certain percentage of it is hard work, but a big percentage is just pure luck. You walk into the right audition on the right day, or your manuscript lands on the right desk on the right day. So I don't think there's any danger of me thinking that it's all just because I'm so totally wonderful. Because I know all along, like every gig I did or didn't get, there was luck involved in that. And this, there's been huge amounts of luck involved in this too. And I do feel insanely lucky. I think most artists, we were saying before, the definition of success is that you get to get up every morning and do what you love. No day job, you just get to do what you love. And I still cannot believe that I'm lucky enough that I get to do that every day.
Without overanalyzing it, I find it interesting because you mentioned the similarities. And one of the similarities, of course, is that as a theater actor, you are working and you are rehearsing and you are working with a group of people. And it is all very solitary until the audience enters the equation. Of course, writing is the ultimate in solitary because it's just you. But what is that, the similarities of then the audience reading what it is that you have been working on?
I think at heart there's the same thing, which is that this does not exist without audience, without a viewer. If I'm writing the book just in the solitude of my room, it's not in its full existence. It doesn't take on life until somebody reads it. This is a three-cornered equation. It's not just all about me and the book. It's about me, the book, and the reader before it takes on its full life. And it's very much the same with theatre. I mean, the difference is obviously there, where in theatre, like if you're having a bad day in rehearsal, there are other actors in the scene, there's a director, somebody is going to be able to give you a nudge or bounce something at you that sets you off. Whereas in writing, if I'm having a bad day, it's me staring at the screen trying not to get distracted by the internet, you know? But that feeling, and there's a lot of trying not to get distracted by the internet in my life. But there is that same process where you have to be aware of the third corner of that equation of the audience, that they are just as crucial as you are and just as crucial as the book is. The big difference is that in theatre, it's immediate. The creation of that spark, that magic, that coming to life, whatever you want to call it, that's immediate. When you get on that stage, you are there and the audience is there. And if you're lucky, if it's a good night, the show takes on that life of its own. It catches fire and you're there to be part of it. Whereas in writing, those two halves of the equation are entirely different. I write the book. My half is done a year before. The other half is done before the audience get to see it. And it, again, if you're lucky, it catches fire. And that's a very strange feeling. I think film acting must be much more like that, where you can't readjust to the audience as you go. You can't go, oh, okay, they're a smaller audience, so we're going to need to pace it up. Or, oh, they're laughing more, so we're going to need to pace it down. You can't shape the performance to your specific audience. You have to just shape the show or the book or whatever, or the film or whatever it is. You have to shape it in isolation and hope that the audience will come to meet it, because you can't make it come to meet them in the same way.
And of course, with acting, as you mentioned, you have your other actors, your fellow actors, you have the script, and there are nets. Whereas in writing these stories, it's ultimately just you.
Yeah, it is. And it's a very strange switch, because, again, I'm coming from acting. You all rehearse together and then you all go to the pub together. And this really is just me. And you do go to the pub together. And this really is just me trying to make it work. I'm lucky. My husband reads for me. He reads stuff as I go along, kind of chapter by chapter. And he's not a fiction reader apart from this. He's a nonfiction reader. But he's got a really good sense of structure and a demon eye for anything sloppy. So he's the one who's reading along going, well, you know, the movement of this book has all been towards the interior. You can't suddenly set a scene out in a field. You know, stuff like that. He's got a good eye for shape. And he makes me cut the dream sequences, for example, because they're pointless. So I have that. I have that much feedback. But it is very strange. And you do have to rely on your own instincts as you go. Because, you know, I've got great editors. I'm very lucky. And I know that if I've done something completely ridiculous, they will pull me out of my own mess. But that's at the end. As I'm going, I just have to be diving in and hoping that my instinct is developed enough that what I think works does, to some extent at least, work.
In this novel, in Broken Harbor, when we learn about Scorcher Kennedy and these secrets, and as I mentioned in the introduction, this is a place that you're writing about where he remembers being happiest, but there is so much more there, and this revelation and things not being what they seem is a fascinating aspect of your work.
Yeah, thank you very much. That, to me, is a big part of this book in particular. The relationship between, I guess, the inner reality and the outer reality. Because I think, for Scorcher in particular, he's a big believer that if you believe something hard enough, then it will become true. And Ireland's had kind of a national wave towards that over the course of our economic boom and crash, where we were being told the economic boom can absolutely last forever if you just believe in it enough. And anyone who warned, hey, hang on, this is kind of built on nothing. This is a bubble. It may not go right. They were just excoriated. They were attacked for, if it all goes wrong, then it'll be your fault. Like, having any sense of an outer reality was considered to be both irrelevant and unpatriotic, actually, to say, wait a minute, our inner reality should match the outer one. when I was writing this book, it took me until after I had finished it for somebody to point out to me that in many ways it's a book about madness. It's a book about mental instability. All of the characters are in some way mentally fragile, either full on, like Scorcher's sister Dina, whose hold on reality is like a finger hold at best, or more subtly fragile in that they're struggling to keep that hold. And for me, all these forms of either mental instability or outright mental illness or mental damage come from a disconnect between that inner and outer reality. Just to take the most common one, like anxiety, there's you see somebody who is nothing is wrong, everything's perfectly okay in their outer lives to look at, but inside their mind there are so many things that they're frightened of going wrong that they become hardly able to function. And I think in every form of mental difficulty can be traced back to that the inner and outer realities just aren't gelling right. And so things not being what they seem comes up throughout this book, and people's lives not being what they seem, people's beliefs not matching their outer world comes up throughout as a source of damage, yeah.
Ultimately, how these various characters learn to cope with the damage that they have, whether it is a self-diagnosis or it is dealing with or suppressing it.
Yeah, and they do deal with it in very different ways. It's funny how much your subconscious does when you're writing. A lot of this is stuff that I did not put in the book deliberately. It just showed up and somebody had to point it out to me afterwards, you know? But the characters who come out of this book, I'm not going to say unscathed, because this is a sad book and a lot of stuff has blown up in people's faces and there is shrapnel everywhere. But the characters who come out of it relatively themselves, if not intact, then still more or less in one piece and able to function, are the characters who are more turned outwards, who pay attention to other people, who are listening and who are seeing what's going on around them, who are more observant in some strange ways. Because for them, the gap between that inner and outer reality isn't as great. The ones who've been trying desperately to force outward reality to match their inner belief system, those are the ones whose world comes crashing down around them, including Scorcher Kennedy, the narrator. His world very much comes crashing down around him because he's always believed so strongly in cause and effect and the rules. If you do everything right, you will get a happy ending. If you feed all the right pieces into the machine, it'll spit out the right solution. In the teeth of the evidence, he's hung on to this belief with a kind of desperation for most of his life because he needs that. And this case brings that belief crashing down. It is not that simple. Things don't always work out the way they should. Cause and effect can be a tangled thing. And so he finds himself in some ways devastated, but in some ways liberated from the tyranny of that belief. And he finds himself able to pick up the pieces of damage that was done a long time ago and start fresh.
There is so much thought to these stories, and they're very thoughtful and very introspective, which leads me to the final question of our conversation, which is, you obviously allow yourself the time to write. How much time do you allow yourself to think about this stuff?
That's a really interesting question. I actually spend loads of time just kind of thinking and wondering. That counts as part of my workday, is just going for long walks and ticking things over in my mind. Because these are psychological mystery novels, the heart of this book is not what was physically done to whom. Is there an unknown poison from the Amazon in the stomach of the victim? You know, that stuff isn't at the heart of this book. It is psychologically what psychological damage and psychological process are what this book is about. How the characters moved from point A, where everything was okay, to point B, where their lives have been devastated. And it's a psychological process that I'm interested in, not the physical one. And in order to write about that, you do have to spend a certain amount of time thinking about who these characters are and how they would get themselves into this. And yeah, I do. That I consider that to be very much part of my job, is trying to work out how mentally and psychologically this all happened.
Tana French's fourth novel is Broken Harbor. It is out from Viking. Tana French, a great pleasure to have you on the book show. I thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.